So Dr. Barrow, we've been looking forward to your being present with us again this morning, and you're handling a subject, why I do not believe in evolution, that perhaps most of us could not. I remember Dr. Barlow told me some time ago, he said, if I did not have a Bible, I still would not believe in evolution. And so perhaps this morning he's going to tell us why.
Thank you very much, Reverend Ford. And may I say again, it's a wonderful privilege for Gene and myself to be back again to where we used to live and to the church that we love so much to attend and still love to get back to. May I correct you, Reverend Ford, one of your announcements. I think perhaps you remember a few moments ago you said that I'll be staying for a few minutes afterwards, and if there are any questions on evolution or creation, and I don't know how far else he went, I'll be happy to answer them. I'll be here. I don't know whether I'll be happy, but I'll do my best. Because it's, of course, a very, very broad subject, evolution, and then creation and the Bible is even broader still. However, I'm so pleased that he didn't discuss this ahead of time, that his first remark, or last remark, rather, introducing me, was that I had said at one time, if I had never had a Bible, if I had never read a Bible, if I had never heard of Bible doctrines, as a scientist, looking at the theory of evolution, I would be unable to believe it. And if you will, take that as my real title this morning for the subject we will discuss. However, I never like to preach without at least some Bible background, so turn, if you will, to Genesis chapter 1, and at verse 1, we will not read all of chapter 1, which is the great creation narrative of the Bible, the beginning of it at least, but I do want to refer you to one or two highlights from that chapter, known so well, I am sure, to you all. Would you notice the first verse, in the beginning God created the heaven and the earth. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And then there follows in succession the 6 days of God's creative acts as recorded in the Bible. And notice particularly at the end of verse 5, the end of the verse, and the evening and the morning were the first day. Then notice verse 8, and the evening and the morning were the second day. And then further creative acts occurred by God, and in verse 13, and the evening and the morning were the third day. And then in verse 19, after further successive creative activities, and the evening and the morning were the fourth day. And following the same sequence, in verse 23, and the evening and the morning were the fifth day. And then, of course, following the same sequence, we find at the end of verse 31, the last verse of chapter 1, and God saw everything that he had made, including man, by the way, if you and I have read the verses, and behold, it was very good. And the evening and the morning were the sixth day. And of course, if you and I want to go further into the Bible narrative of our origins, we would find it in chapter 1 and in subsequent explanations throughout the Bible. However, our theme this morning is not so much to look at the Bible narrative, but look at the alternative which has been suggested for some 100 or so years now, and that is evolution. May I point out in passing that evolution is taught as almost universally accepted. You can pick up literally hundreds of journals or magazines, scientific or lay. You can pick up literally hundreds of books. You can walk into every high school and to every college throughout the United States and most of the world today, and you will find that evolution is never really taught thoroughly, but it is always presented as being so obviously true that you are foolish to doubt. And I submit to you this morning that this is very, very far from what is really so. As a matter of fact, some member of the congregation put into Reverend Thorne's hands, I believe, this morning, from the issue of the Reader's Digest of August 1973, hot off the press, an article again concerning some anthropological studies and diggings into the fossils of man's origin. And as I turned this very quickly, as I was sitting at the front, I read these words: according to current evolutionary doctrine. Notice the word. It's no longer a theory, it's no longer a guess, it's no longer a supposition, it is now a doctrine. That is, an established principle. So say our scientific textbooks. I'm going to question evolution this morning, and I'm going to raise some very, very serious questions for you to ponder about, and then I'm going to offer you some alternatives. First of all, let me point out that there are only three major theories, doctrines, principles, whatever they are, put forward today to account for the origin of the universe and your origin and mine. The first, of course, is evolution. I want to list 7 points of defining evolution. And I have tried sincerely, simply, honestly, carefully, scientifically, to call the evolutionary literature and fairly present the real core of the belief in evolution. Here it is. First of all, in progress from a mixture of atoms to simple compounds. Somewhere, say the evolutionists, billions of years ago, in all the billions upon billions upon billions of random scattering of atoms, some simple atoms somehow came together at the precise point, into the precise order, and under the precise conditions to form the simplest chemical compound. And of course, from that, through some other series of random chances, these compounds were able to link together, and so on, and so on, and so on, and so on, until we got even the beginning of something fairly complex, such as a single protein or starch molecule. This, of course, has to be where evolution begins. Secondly, these changes were extremely small, requiring billions of years. Evolution needs billions of years for such minute changes to occur in a random fashion. You see, they're up against the probabilities of your life. And they have to say that if you wait enough billions of years, these things must or may occur. And I'm going to question that later on. And then somewhere along the chain, amongst those billions of years, somehow or other, when we finally got some of these complex compounds, and they were able to link together in very complex ways, we had somehow unexplained the spontaneous origin of life in at least the simplest sub-chemical or sub-biological material, if you will. Somehow, some amino acid, some protein, some starch, in some unbelievable way, were able to all of a sudden exhibit the characteristics of life and be able to reproduce and to have irritability, the other things that biologists tell us are characteristic of life. Then further, there was a progression of life upward from a single living cell to all living varieties that we see, the trees, the birds, the animals, including, and I say it carefully, the human animal. For the evolutionist tells us that you and I are nothing more than the highest developed animal so far in the evolutionary chain. Those are the first 4 points, if you will. And then, fifthly, I can't take the time to look into it this morning, this was made possible through the survival of the fittest. As a single cell multiplied and various single cells reproduced, some were slightly more fit than others to adapt to the environment. Therefore, they survived and became the platform for the next level of complexity. Now, there are two more points besides those five in evolution, and I want to be fair and say they are not explicitly stated in evolutionary theory, but they must be inherent and inferred if evolution is true. And the sixth point, the first of these two, is this: man is simply the highest animal. If God did not create me, if I have no spirit, if I do not have a spiritual origin, then I do not have a spiritual existence. And evolution has to infer that I am simply nothing more than an animal, part of a brute creation. And then the seventh point, also inferred and obvious, I think, is this. If I am simply the end of an animal chain of progression, then no God is ever present. God is not needed. God is not needed to create. God is not needed to contribute or to control. Therefore, evolution has to infer God is useless, there is no God. You know, nowadays we have this theory, God is dead. Let me say this, evolution has to teach God never was born. And it's blasphemy to even say this. God never existed, therefore he could not live, even God. So much for evolution, and that is its basic tenets. Each one of these can be explored further. May I point out now to creation? And the Bible narrative of creation says very simply, and I really only list 3 points this morning, God always existed. There was a pre-existing creator, point number one. Point number two, and we've read something of that this morning, the Bible tells me that there were 6 literal days of creation. The evening and the morning were the first day, the second day, and so on. Thirdly, man is infinitely more than an animal. God created man in his image, not in the animal's image. And while you and I share with animals much of our physical characteristics, we do not share with animals, but with the spirit world, the fact that we have a spirit and have a God consciousness. If I do not believe evolution, I will have to believe creation. So people said, up until perhaps some years ago. And then earnest Bible-believing Christians said, we cannot give up the feeling that the basic tenets of evolution must be true. We cannot either give up our Bible, which tells us that God exists, and that God created, and that God loved, and that God the Son died, and that we have a Redeemer. Let's marry the two. Let's create a third alternative. Let us agree that the basic tenets of evolution are true, and that the basic beliefs of the Bible are true, and let's try to force them together to make a system, a theory, that is true to both. We may have to bend each, but let's do it. And various forms of this are current today. Some are called theistic evolution. Evolution, but God was behind it, theo for God. Others call it progressive creationism, a slightly different version. This says that the billions of years of evolution in the upward steps are essentially true, but wherever we cannot see a fossil, wherever we cannot find how the next step came, God undoubtedly stepped in and created that one. It's a marriage of the two, you see. Progressive creationism, theistic evolution as a third alternative. We mentioned earlier that I want to look at evolution for its own sake. Let me say at this point that for the remainder of our time, I'm going to take up some flaws in the theory of evolution. But let me say, too, that if we can see that evolution on its own merits is scientifically invalid, then theistic evolution is also invalid. And I have nothing left than the Bible narrative of creation. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. I only have 3 alternatives. The first two hang together, evolution or theistic evolution. If they are untenable, I am left only with creation. Now let's look for a few minutes at creation or evolution itself. First of all, it contradicts the second law of thermodynamics. Why do you say, for a hot July Sunday morning in the Baptist church, why do we want to hear about the second law of thermodynamics? May I make it simple if I can? This simply says, in my language, in layman's language, that if a system starts out complex and if left alone, it always deteriorates and falls apart into simple random components. Systems left to themselves don't start simple and become complex. And I'm trying to think of some way this morning to have at least some illustration of this. It's a forum, if you will, but I'm going to start with a rather very, very simple but complex system. I have here in my hand, and those in the church can see it this morning, I'm holding it up in my left hand, 50 8x5 or 3x5 index cards. You can't see more than the front one. On the front one, I've labeled the letter 1. are the number one. I've numbered them consecutively from 1 to 50. Here they are. If I could spread them wide enough, you'd see them. Now, if I leave these alone over space and time, they will in fact decay. But subject to the pressures of the environment, they will not get more complex. They cannot rearrange themselves in specific sequences. If anything, they will go in random fashion like this. And there they go. And I throw them in the air, and they're falling down through the auditorium this morning, and I defy anyone here to start on the left or at the right or at any point and pick them up in successive fashion and find that they are still numbered 1 to 50. Number 15 is probably next to number 2. Number 17 is probably next to number 19 or number 5. What has happened? Because of the pressures of the environment and time, they have gone in random fashion. Do you for a minute think that I could pick these cards up and shuffle them together as they are now randomly and throw them up again and have them come down in sequence 1 to 50? Absolutely not. How much more is possible to take the random billions of atoms and assume that they can fall together to make the simplest complex compound, which will then over billions of years continue to fall together until we end up in 1973 with a human genocide? It is manifestly impossible. The first flaw, and a serious one, in the theory of evolution is the fact that it disobeys the second law of thermodynamics. And this has been a point of concern for evolutionists down throughout the years. The second problem is this, that, and it's really linked to the first, that the statistical probability is against it. Let's suppose they could have linked up in 1 to 50 if I threw them up enough times. How many hundreds of times would I have to throw those few cards in random fashion up in the air, pick them up from left to right, throw them again, and so on, until I got them numerically in order, 1 to 50. Guess hundreds, if you will, guess thousands. I don't know. But let me say this. Long before it occurred, the cards will have worn out, and they will no longer be capable of being handled. It's equivalent, if you like, to asking a monkey to take the parts of an alarm clock in a wash basin and to shake those 40 or 50 parts and shake them and shake them and shake them until at some magic, miraculous moment in time, they all fall together in a three-dimensional stereo position and drop into place and the clock starts clicking again. It is obviously impossible for two reasons. The probability is against it, and secondly, as the monkey keeps shaking those parts, long before he may wear out, or a succession of monkeys will wear out, the parts themselves become worn. So they will no longer fit together, even if they have the chance. They will become rusted. And at the end of some 2 years, the monkey that is still alive will be shaking a pan of ashes and dust. The probability statistic says that that cannot happen. How much less putting together the simple compound to get to the complex billions of compounds individually that go to make up even lower forms of life, let alone more of it. You know that my brain alone, at least I hope it does, contains over 1 billion nerve cells. Each nerve cell with parts to it, within that nerve cell, complex chemical compounds, all performing their function so that I can think fairly reasonably. It is probability, statistically rather, improbable that such events could occur, even with these few 50 cards that we have thrown up here this morning. Thirdly, evolutionists will say, never mind these things, the only real proof of evolution is the fossil record. Forget the theory, Mr. Marlowe, forget the theory, Mr. Critic, let's take a look at the fossil record. And as we dig in the rocks, we find that we have in the earliest rocks the simplest material, the one cell, the simple cell compounds, or rather, the forms of life. And then in the higher levels of the strata, separated by billions of years, presumably, we have the higher, and then the highest forms. Let me point out to you that the fossil record is the only real record of the possibility of evolution. And the fossil record has two fatal flaws. First of all, we do not always
And in fact, in many cases, we do not find that the deepest level of rock has the simplest biological form. There are square miles of the Earth's surface where the higher levels of rock, presumably the most recent, contain the simpler form. And as we drill through, we find in the lower levels of rock the more complex form. You know what the evolutionary scientist says? We're still right because somehow there must have been a cataclysm on the Earth's surface, and these rocks underneath slid out from these rocks above and then came back over. And there are square miles of deep thick of such rocks which we find explanation. Let me say it again because it's important. The fossil record does not always go, in many cases does not go, from the simplest and the deepest to the most complex forms up on the closer to the top of the Earth level. Secondly, and I don't know whether you realize this, we speak of a missing link between monkeys and humans. You know that at every step in the chain there are missing links between the earliest form and the next simple form. There's an intermediate step missing. Between that form and the next, a link is missing. Between that form and the next, a link is missing. All the way up the line. Evolutionists are puzzled by the fact that as they get to some earlier or later Mesozoic age or something like that, all of a sudden the fossils in those rocks are complete and new, and they cannot show a progression from the earlier fossils in the presumably earlier rocks. The fossil record has missing links at every step. And as I said earlier, in some cases those steps are reciprocals of each other and are in the wrong order. You know, some time ago I took the liberty of preparing a little outline in connection with evolution, and I posed a series of questions that any high school student or college student could respectfully and sincerely and courteously ask his high school or college teacher. Listen to some of these. Mr. Teacher, for any specific fossil that you have showed me as proof of evolution, in what location was this found? In what layer of sedimentary rock was it found? What is the estimated age of this rock? Who estimated the age of the rock? What are his qualifications? What method of dating was used? How reliable is this method? Who found the fossil? What are his qualifications? Who classified the fossil? What are his qualifications? Exactly what fragments were found? If the fossil, by the way, has been pictured as reconstructed with skin, hair, eyes, features, and you've seen the pictures in the textbooks, haven't you? Of a fossil with the long hair, whatever it is, were the skin, hair, eyes found as part of fossil? If not, for fossils are only pieces of bone and teeth, as far as the brain is concerned. Skin, hair, and eyes, by the way, will not persist over centuries. Therefore, the fossils are only pieces of a jawbone, or pieces of a thigh bone, or sheep, or something like that. And if, Mr. Professor, Mr. Teacher, this picture you show me has a picture of a reconstructed face or body, why has this imaginary material been presented? What other evidences of evolution are also imaginary? There are several other questions. One in particular I'd like to leave with you. In some evolutionary and biological textbooks, they have a series of pictures of a giraffe. And they show how that presumably millions of years ago, giraffes had short necks. But in periods of drought, only the longer necked giraffes could reach the leaves. Therefore, they were the ones that survived. And then years later, with some a little longer, a little shorter, in the next drought period, the longer necks survive again. Until we get the long necked giraffes at the end. Let me say this. There is no fossil evidence of such a sequence of giraffes. And this question you probably ask if this picture is shown to you in school. Is there a fossil series showing gradual lengthening of the giraffe's neck over millions or thousands of years? If this fossil evidence is available, why is it not pictured and discussed in the text? If this fossil evidence is not available, why is this fictitious story presented? Is it because there is no real evidence? How much other evidence of evolution is fictitious? And I could go on much longer. There's a fourth flaw in the theory of evolution. No evolutionary changes are occurring today. the evolutionist says, wait a minute, it takes billions of years. The changes are so small, you would not expect to see them. Well, perhaps so. But I would like to see some evidence if the fossil record can't be. And if the only remaining evidence is not the fossil past, but the living present, then, Mr. Scientist, show me that frame. I can see different forms, shapes, sizes, colors of cats, but a cat is still a cat. I don't see something halfway between a cat and a dog. I see a variety of different birds, but a bird is still a bird. And I see no change, no word. I see no bizarre or unusual form developing, as evolutionary theory says it has to do. And then there is a fifth and very serious flaw, to me, in the theory of evolution, and we discussed it earlier, really, now I'd like to link up with it. It does not account for man's spirit of sex. Do you realize that the animals have no God consciousness? You never see a group of giraffes, or a zebra, or horses, or cows, or birds, or cats gathering in a circle and pawing the ground or whatever they can do and trying to make some idol and bowing down to it. There is a complete absence of any sense of spirituality in animals, but it pervades your life among us. And in dark Africa or any other place, the heathen who has never heard the Bible will put up his own God and will worship the heathen God in stone, in wood, and of iron. Man has put into him a then theistic evolution, any marriage between evolution and Bible creation is also false, and I am left with only the Bible narrative. And I believe in the 6 literal days of creation, as my Bible says, with all my heart. I have seen nothing in evolution apart from the Bible, which makes it valid to me as a scientist. Now then, if this is so, what can I offer the down in heart? What can I offer the fallen heart? What can I offer the sinner? What can I offer the drunkard? What can I offer the terrorist? What can I offer the broken home? I can go to the drunkard and I can say, don't worry about it, you're only an animal, and in a few billion years things will be right. And it will not relieve him of his drunkenness or restore his broken home. But I can preach God's love and the forgiveness of sin, and the preaching of the Bible will reform the drunkard. I can go to the heartbroken and say, look at the bees and the birds and the animals. They lose things too. They lose their children. They lose their relatives to death. After all, you're just like them. You're only an animal. And it will not heal the broken heart. I can pick this book up and read, let not your heart be troubled. And I can go from cover to cover and give you the hope of happiness once again with the Bible preaching. How about the consciousness of sin? The deep burden of guilt, the need for a redeemer, the need to be made right with an infinite God. I can preach evolution till I'm blue in the face, and will never meet that need. But when I pick my Bible up, I read this, not only in the beginning, God created, but I turn to John 3:16, and I read that God who created, for God so loved the world, that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish, but have everlasting life.
Evolution today is not a doctrine, it's a theory.
It's an unproven theory, it's an untenable theory. It rests on a shaky foundation. It gives no hope to those who need hope and encouragement and sins forgiven and eternal life. The Bible gives the clearest, simplest, most plausible, most correct story of our origin, and it gives the hope of sins forgiven and of eternity through believing in the Lord Jesus Christ.
Well, those of you who have tuned our way within the last 25 or 30 minutes or so, you have been worship broadcast from the First Baptist Church, New Falls, New York. And our guest speaker has been Dr. John Barlow, who is a scientist, who's a Christian, and been talking to us on the subject, why I do not believe in evolution. Now, if you did not get all the answers this morning, for those of you who are here, we're going to meet for a few moments after we go up here this morning, down here in front, and Dr. Barlow, I'm sure,